The following is a presentation of Geekster Media.
Hello there, and welcome to another edition of The Wizard Files, the special interview series where we go behind the scenes with former employees of Wizard Magazine and the comic book professionals whose work filled its pages. This time around, we're talking to a man who not only had a hand in bringing Wizard Magazine to newsstands for over a decade, but also had a career at Valiant and Acclaim Comics, as well as being the founder and CEO of After Hours Press. It's Darren Sanchez. Welcome to the show.
Great to be here. Nice to meet you, Adam, and I'm happy to talk to you.
Yeah, looking forward to getting your reminiscence there. We do want to send a shout out to a past guest on the podcast, Michael Dolce, for introducing us and giving us a chance to have this conversation. But we kind of want to go back to the beginning. We want to know all about the Wizard days, but we also want to understand, how did you first discover comic books?
Oh man, I'm dating myself, but that's okay. Back in the mid to late 70s, I was a little kid and we used to go visit my aunts and uncles, and two of my older cousins collected comics. I read everything that they had. I read their whole collection. One of them collected Marvel, like the early Amazing Spider-Man, you know, like when Tarantula was in it and, you know, that kind of stuff. And the other one is a girl, and she liked the DC World's Finest. She liked the horror comics. She liked Commandy, you know, stuff like that. And she ended up giving me or gifting me her whole collection, like later on when we were adults. But so that was kind of nice. Yeah. So that's how I got started. And I've been collecting ever since. I mean, through life, you know, you get married. I was in the army, and I still managed to drag my collection around with me every time I moved. So yeah, I've been into comics since the 70s.
That's wild. I am curious. So before you became a professional, you're getting into the business in the early 90s. In the 80s for you, like, what were like the big titles? Who were the creators you were following? Like, what was the number one for you, maybe?
Well, the 80s, before I joined the army, I was in high school. That's when Secret Wars came out. And that kind of got me back into it. I was always kind of dabbling in it and collecting here and there, you know, from 7-Eleven, the spinner racks, you know, that kind of get a Slurpee and a couple of comics. But Secret Wars, it was to the point where I would go back and I was wondering, when's the next one coming out? Because I don't know if they were running late or if I was just impatient, but I just remember I couldn't wait for the next one to come out. And back then I didn't really know the writers and artists, but I got to know Bob Layton very well after that. And we've talked a lot about Secret Wars and stuff. So it's kind of fun, but that's what really got me back into it. And then when I was in the army, McFarlane's run on Spider-Man. At first, I didn't like it, believe it or not. I thought it was too weird and I just didn't like it, but it kind of grew on me and I kept buying them and then I just started liking them. And then Frank Miller's run on Dark Knight Returns, I remember buying all those right off the newsstand and I, you know, I still have all those, but those were the ones that kind of got me hooked and kept me in it.
Yeah, that's awesome. So now the interesting thing is you decided to go from, you know, fan to actually working in the business. You had a career at Valiant Comics in the early 90s. You're becoming a production manager there. You know, if you flip to the back of the book, there's Darren Sanchez listed alongside everybody else. But you also eventually ended up writing a few stories for their line of comics. So how did you go from like in the army helicopter pilot to then working in the world of comic books?
Well, I got out of the army after the 91 Gulf War. I moved to New York where my parents were. I'm originally from Houston. I got an internship at Valiant I was taking some night classes at the School of Visual Arts in Manhattan. And Carmine Infantino was my instructor in sequential art. I wanted to be an artist and a writer, and he was a great teacher. I mean, he was a little kind of callous, but he was great. And he must have known someone at Valiant because he recommended that some of his students reach out to Valiant because he heard they were looking for interns. So I started as an intern there. I went from being a warrant officer in the Army to just a few months later emptying garbage cans at Valiant for no pay. I started doing production work, and I eventually got the job as production manager. When they fired the current production manager, the bosses there, Fred Pierce, actually, was Israeli Army, and he knew I was an officer in the military just a few months before, and he said, "Darren, you're the only adult in the room here, so I think I'm going to put you in charge of the department." And I was 23 at the time, and I told him I don't know shit about production except for, you know, pay stuff, which is some of the stuff I'd been doing. And he's like, "Don't worry, they'll teach you. You can manage people. That's what we really need." So that was how my career got started, and I did that for 5 years. I was actually the director there when they got their first computers, when they went from coloring in a watercolor style to a computer color. Valiant and Image both kind of switched over about the same time. We had, like, I think it was Photoshop 1. You know, we were basically all learning Photoshop at the same time. So yeah, that's how the career got started. I just always wanted to be an artist, and night classes at SVA turned into a career in comics.
That's so awesome. Now, I have to ask, so did your promotion and that moving of the old guard, was that because Jim Shooter had been pushed out, so then his crew was out and then the job opened up for you? Like, people talk about Jim Shooter, there's people that hate him and there's people that are like, no, he was an amazing genius. So, like, where do you fall?
I think everybody respects him. The people who deal with him or dealt with him personally, they have varying opinions, but mine is that he's brilliant. You know, I think most brilliant people do have some shortcomings when it comes to dealing with people. So, you know, I guess you got to just kind of take the good with the bad. But no, it had nothing to do with that. I when I first got there, Barry Windsor Smith and Jim still had offices. They were just leaving. So I only met them in passing like one or two times. But it turned out the production guy actually got fired. I don't know if I could say this on your show. If not, just bleep it out. But he actually got fired for watching porn in the conference room.
Damn it.
Which turned out to be to my benefit. And it was like this Japanese cartoon porn that he was watching. And so they fired him. And then that's when Fred asked me to run the department.
That's hilarious. I mean, this is the days before the internet even. He had to go seek that out and then choose to watch it at work. Come on,
it guys. Was a VHS. I guess he didn't have a VHS player at his house. I have no idea. So.
Now, listeners to our podcast know I'm a big Valiant fan. I loved, like, the first run of Exo Manowar. When Acclaim Comics happened, Quantum and Woody is my jam. I love that so much. So you were there to experience that transition. What was that like when they're telling you, okay, now we're Acclaim Comics, Fabian's in charge? Like, tell me a little bit about that.
Wow. The transition, Steve Mazarsky was like the one constant, because after Bob left, Steve Mazarsky was there. They knew we had to do something. Fred Pierce was also there, but he was more business than creative. And they needed a new editor in chief because, you know, Bob had left. They were looking at different people. Joey Cavallari actually interviewed, and he interviewed well. But I think they were hoping for a bigger name. They were going to let me do it because they knew I could do it. And I had a ton of ideas, but they heard Fabian was interested. And so Fabian came in and did it. And Fabian and I are still very close friends to this day. So we work together there. We also work together at Starlight Runner, and he's done a lot of shows with me. And so Fabian's one of my best friends in the world, him and Mike Dolce, actually. But the transition was a little weird. It was like, we knew we had to do our flagship books, but he didn't want to do them the same way. He brought in his buddies, Kurt Busiek, Mark Wade, just a nice list of really talented creators, and they put their own spins on things. But Fabian wanted to create some new stuff too. He created Troublemakers with Kenny Martinez, who is now Juan Doe. He wrote a new run on Turok, where Turok was a teenage boy, and he got the team together to put Quantum and Woody. And a lot of that, it is the creative team that did it, but a lot of that snarkiness came from Fabian, who, you know, you could tell it's like Deadpool-ish, you know. Yeah. And so the whole fourth wall kind of thing, that was a lot of it came from brainstorm sessions between the creative team and Fabian. Yeah, it was a great time. And I attribute most of what I learned about how to make comics to guys like Kevin Van Hook and Fabian and Bob Layton and Don Perlin, Tony Bedard, a lot of really, really talented people that I had the privilege of working with. Joe Quesada came up through that. Joe and Jimmy Palmiotti, so many. Bob Layton used to do classes to help, because he needed inkers. So he would take potential artists who had okay portfolios, but some talent, and he would teach them how to ink. And they would stay after hours and do some inking classes. And the table was always surrounded by people watching. He also did the same for me with writing. And we would sit, we'd have Chinese food or something, and we'd just talk about writing. And I would turn in stuff and he would tell me why that sucked. Or, Darren, that's not a story, man. That's just like a scene. Yeah, it's like a barroom fight is not a story. You know, so I learned a lot of the basic, and some of those rules came from Jim Shooter too. You know, so he had some really weird rules, like, you know, smoke flows from left to right, you know, that kind of stuff. But storytelling, keeping it simple, the middle act twists, the point of no return, all of these little screenwriting terms and how they apply to good comic book stories, the can't must situations that you have to put a hero in. There's certain rules on covers. He doesn't like covers where the hero is too small. They don't like covers where it's a helpless hero cover. Bob Layton got pissed because there was one month where all Valiant's heroes were like beaten up and chained things. And he's like, no more helpless hero covers, no more. And so little things like that, kind of, you learn a lot just by being around it. And it was a great time.
Yeah. Now, one thing I wanted to ask a little bit about is, so there, you know, obviously this era of Valiant that you were there going into Acclaim, like this was like still like, you know, a boom period, especially those early 90s. And one of those big events was Deathmate, which there was a lot of like, oh, it shipped late, you know, Valiant stuff got out, Images stuff didn't, and all that. I was just curious, like, how involved were you in any of the Deathmate books, and what was your whole opinion of how that came together?
Well, I was involved as the production manager, and I was also the managing editor. So it came out on time because of all the planning that we did, and all their books are based around their artists at Image, and all our books were based around the traditional way of doing things, where you have a team and an editor and an artist listens to their editor. But over there, it was the inmates running the asylum. So if the artist says he's too busy, I'll turn it in next week. The editor's powerless to do anything about that. So that's why their books always ran late. They were young, they were super talented, and they had, their plate was too full. And I don't think this was their priority. They were focused on their own books. You know, this was just kind of a side deal. So while ours came out on time, theirs didn't. And it kind of killed the steam from the project. But my experience with the project was all good, except for just waiting for the red and black one to come out. You know, that was, you know, but otherwise the blue and yellow, they came out on time and they were good.
And now the other thing I wanted to ask you about, just because, you know, you're mentioning your roles and your titles, you know, managing editor, production manager, all those types of things, was mainly your job just like, okay, get the job done so we can get it to the printer? I mean, is that essentially you're just trying to get everything out in the pipeline?
I was in charge of the team. And back then it took a team because it was a bullpen back then. We had the artists who drew the books were actually there. We didn't have online. We had FedEx, but that was expensive. So we preferred to have artists who lived in New York City and came to work. Sean Chen, Bernard Chang, Rex Morales for a while, Andrew Wendell. There was a lot of them. And they would come in, and the colorists too. And they would all do it right there at their drawing tables. And my team, the production team, would take the boards. We would put the lettering on with acetate and all the stuff. So in the registration marks, and then we'd have all 20 or 21 boards, and we'd pack them up and we'd send them off to the scanner, because nobody had a scanner. They had to be drum scanned at a facility in Long Island. And then the film came back, and we had to make sure the film was clean, so it wasn't like all sloppy and spots all over it. And then we sent that film to the printer. So there was a lot more processes other than getting your PDF ready and then dropping it on a server somewhere. It's a lot different now. And I think that's why more indie books are published now, is because it's easier to do. You needed a lot more expertise, I think. And same with the movie industry, you know, the laptops and the can, you know, it's just easier to get your ideas out there today because there's not so much of a production process.
Yeah, for sure. Now, one way that you guys were able to do promotion, which Valiant had some really awesome, you know, marketing and promotion back in the day, but one of the pipelines eventually was Wizard Magazine. Obviously, we're a Wizard Magazine podcast. There was a whole Valiant era special that was produced. Absolutely. And things like that. So what was your first exposure to and then opinion of Wizard Magazine before you started working there?
Well, one of the perks of working at Valiant was that we would get comps of all the comics that were coming out. Image, we were trade comps, basically. We would send packages to Image and to the editors at Marvel and DC, and they would do the same to us. So, you know, that we would get boxes in all the time, and people had comics stacked up all over the place. And so comics were just abundant there. And we made a similar arrangement with Wizard. So they would send us their magazines so that we, you know, we could read them, because they wanted us to send them our comics for free so that they didn't have to buy them, and all their editors could read them, which, you know, is beneficial editorially. And I think our opinion was that they were a little snarky. They were kind of too smart ass for their own good in some ways. Like, we didn't understand how they expect to insult people or insult the publisher and then have someone go around and try and sell them ads. You know, it's like, fuck you, we're not buying ads from you. And so to me, that was one of the first things that struck me when we started reading the magazine, is that it was clear that there was an editorial voice that didn't give two shits about the business. And I think that was part of the appeal, is that they were straight shooters. And at Valiant, the guys all kind of, their opinion was that it was a fun read, but that they wished they would cover Valiant more, because all they ever did was insult Valiant at first. The art sucks, this is, you know, that kind of stuff, talking about the production values, things that they really didn't know what they were talking about, you know, as far as that kind of stuff. You got a writer who's like 22 years old who has no idea what goes on beyond what he's reading, you know. So we took it with a grain of salt, and they eventually started covering Valiant a lot more, and we were all big fans of Wizard. We really liked Wizard. So yeah, no complaints there, other than, why don't they cover us more and quit insulting us? And eventually the quality of our books, I think maybe they started appreciating it more. You could see it reflected in their top tens. You could see it in their price guide. You know, all the stuff Valiant was doing back then was really, really good. And that, to me, is attributed to guys like Barry Windsor Smith, Jim Shooter, Bob Layton, Kevin Van Hook, Joe Quesada. Those guys are no joke. Talented guys.
Yeah, for sure. And I'll just say, like, my first issue of Wizard I ever picked up was issue 7 that had Exo Manowar on the cover, you know? So like, for me, I was just like, oh, Valiant's awesome. They're doing cool stuff over there. So again, we're talking about Valiant's happening, then Acclaim is happening, then Acclaim is not happening eventually. Right. So right. How did you end up working at Wizard Magazine? Did you come in as a production director and manager? Because you first appeared in Masthead in 1997. It's issue 71.
I was one of the few people at Valiant who actually had a contract. Steve Mazarsky said, we're going to do layoffs and we're going to be down to a skeleton crew, but I want to make sure that you're one of the ones that are here. And I told him, you know, I have a new baby. I can't do that and have to worry about getting fired every Monday or every Friday or whatever. And he said, how about if I give you a 3-year contract? So I had a contract that even if he fired me, they would still owe me the pay for 3 years. And so I was happy. But then 2 months later, Fred Pierce calls me. Fred had left Valiant and went to be the president of Wizard, because Garib, as creative as he is, he needed a business person to help him, because they were doing some really stupid shit. They were making a lot of money because their book was good, but business-wise, they were losing a lot of money just from inexperience. I mean, Garib was young. Pat McCallum was young. They had a good vibe. They had a good thing going, but they had no adults helping them run it. And so they brought Fred in, and Fred immediately fired their production person. He didn't think that person knew what they were doing. And he called me and asked me to come work at Wizard. And he said, Darren, you're in Brooklyn now. I know you want to come up to Rockland County. And I told him, Fred, I can't go. I just signed a contract. Darren, that contract was to protect you. Steve Mazarsky will let it slide. I'm like, Steve won't let it slide. I'm going to end up getting sued. He said, let me take the risk. And so he apparently had a long argumentative conversation with Steve Mazarsky, and long story short, I ended up leaving. And so I thank Fred for that, because, you know, I wanted my kids to not go to school in Brooklyn and to go to school in more of a suburban neighborhood like where I grew up in Texas. And so I ended up being there for 12 years at Wizard and wearing a lot of different hats, you know, started off as a production manager, and I ended up running different departments, advertising. When we bought the convention company, I was the floor manager for all the shows, helping you know, vendors and retailers set up their spaces and reserve their spaces. I worked very close with Martha Donato, and I learned a lot. I really, honestly, I've done every job in comics except for maybe accounting. And I've done accounting for my own company, but not on a big scale where I have to pay a ton of people and, you know, all that kind of stuff. So yeah, I mean, I've written diamond solicitations. I've run booths. I ran the Wizard World booth at San Diego Comic-Con 1 year. That was crazy. Yeah, I've worn a lot of hats in 12 years.
Sounds like it. I'm curious. So when you first got to Congers, New York, you're now going to work in the offices there. What was your first project? What did you have to fix? What did you have to whip into shape? Do you remember, like, oh no, guys, like, we got to be doing it this way?
Well, the first thing was that I don't know if you ever experienced being the new kid in school or the new kid on a softball team or something. They're going to put you in right field and bat you ninth, that kind of thing. And you kind of got to prove yourself. Fred just wanted me to get a handle on the schedules, because Pat was a creative, I could say it, a creative genius. He really was. He had a great tone for what we were doing. And it was his voice and his tone, that his sense of humor that radiated through most of the books. But he wasn't the greatest when it came to scheduling. And when we expanded into multiple magazines, you know, Toy Fair, Inquest, it became multiple teams, multiple schedules, a lot of moving parts, you know, and the same kind of humor was in all of them. So I give them a lot of credit for that, but he wanted me to basically get a handle on all the schedules, make sure that all the books come out on time, because the printers were really being jerked around. They would get half the book on this date, and then, you know, they want to go to press, but they need this, or they have to wait for the editors to approve the blue lines. And we were losing a lot of money from the printer charging overtime. And so we needed to send them files that were right the first time, or film that was right the first time. That was my first job, was to work with the printers, to build a schedule, work with the editors, to maintain the schedule, and then whatever systems I wanted to put in place, do it. So that's what I did. I don't think the editors understood what I was doing. You know, most of them probably looked at me as redundant or unnecessary at first. I mean, I got to know them all. They're all good guys, you know, like Brian Cunningham, you know, just all good guys, you know, Mike Searle from Inquest and Tom Sulzewski, Mike Fasolo, a ton of those guys are great guys. But at first, they didn't know what I really did. Doug Goldstein was trying to hold it together because he understood how to use Excel, but he didn't really know much else, you know. And so I came in, and it was my job to do all the boring stuff. I got into it because I wanted to be a writer and an artist, you know. And so after doing that for a long time, I decided that I know all the right people. I don't know why I'm not doing this. So I told Fred, I'm going to start my own publishing company. I'm going to still do my job here, but I'm going to start my own publishing company. And he said, Darren, as long as you're not doing it during work hours, I don't give a shit. And I said, okay, so I'll call it After Hours Press. And that's why it's called that, is because I could only work on it after hours. So yeah, that's how that all started.
That's awesome. Now, going back to, you know, getting to know everybody and all that, you know, in the pages of the magazine, Wizard is presenting itself as kind of the wild geek frat house. Did you, as someone who was upstairs, experience any of the shenanigans firsthand?
Oh yeah, absolutely. Well, let me just tell you about the upstairs downstairs thing. You've probably heard about any kind of creative company, whether it's Lucasfilm, Disney, Marvel, DC, you have the creatives and you have the business people. At Wizard, it just happened to be that they were geographically separated by floors. There was no more animosity than any other creative company between the business people and the creatives. It's like the army, which I also have experience with. The enlisted guys hate the officers. And it's just, you know, with some exceptions, you think they're like soft and they don't work very hard and they're so fucking stupid, you know, that kind of thing, because you're in your 20s and you know everything. You know, some of these editors who were down there, honestly, I have a little more perspective. That was the case. That was their first fucking job. They never had any other job other than that one. And so they didn't really know how it worked. And if they're seeing that Pat is griping to Steve Blackwell about something, they're going to chime in with, yeah, those guys upstairs are fucking idiots, you know? And so it's just, I think people just kind of are loyal to their group, and that's all it was. If a business guy says, look, guys, you got to stop being so negative about, I don't know, the DC books, okay? We're trying to sell them fucking ads, and we can't sell a single ad because of this article you wrote. Tone it down. So out of that meeting, you'll get the fucking guys upstairs, they're at it again, you know, that kind of thing. So that was the problem, but it was the same problem that's in every creative company. So just to lay that to rest a little bit, but the frat house environment, oh, it was there. We had the pinball machines and a ping pong table. I brought in a foosball table, but honestly, I brought it in because I was good at foosball. We used to play foosball in flight school. That's all we did. And so we studied, we flew, and then we came back and played foosball. And that was seriously all we did for like months. So I got a professional level table. And we had tournaments, we had ping pong, foosball. We even had tournaments on N64 wrestling. I was always Scott Steiner.
Papa Pub. All right.
Right. And Ian Feller was always Rick Steiner. We were the tag team champions for a while, but you know, it fluctuated. Pat never really cared about winning. He just wanted to have some flair. He would be going off the top rope instead of trying to pin you. You know, he would try that kind of thing. So it was like that. You know, sometimes guys were just trying to win. Other times they were just trying to showboat, you know, and have some fun. So no one took it too seriously, but everybody enjoyed it and everybody stayed late. You know, I told my wife I was working late, you know, but I had a championship match, you know. But I also brought in, Jim McLaughlin used to do it before I got there, but I ran the softball team for Wizard, and I tried to get games up with everybody. When I was at Valiant, I had the softball team and we played Wizard. That was my first time ever going to Rockland County and seeing the neighborhood. But when I was at Wizard, we had a team and we played DC, we played Marvel in Central Park. We weren't very good. You know, we're mostly editors and stuff. You know, there was a couple of athletes, Joe Yanarella, Mike Searle, both of them very good. Yeah, it was a lot of fun. I was involved in a lot of that.
I actually have Mike Fasolo's jersey, his softball jersey. He sent it to us for our archives, which was awesome.
My wife still wears mine once in a while. It's in my t-shirt drawers.
Outside of the camaraderie, I'm curious, what became some of the best perks for you working at Wizard? I mean, obviously, you're there for 12 years, so it sounds like it was a stable job. But creatively, you had plans. Did it help in that way?
Creatively, I think I learned more when I was at Valiant because I was around the actual comic creators. At Wizard, I was around business people and journalists, which is not the same thing. Although they might argue that they're qualified comic editors, they are now. I mean, Mike Cotton, Brian Cunningham, long successful careers, you know. But back then, they were magazine editors. They knew a lot about comics, but not about what I'm talking about. But the perks for me, when the convention started, since I was the one running the floor and kind of deciding where people sit in Artist Alley and stuff like that, if we had room, I could just pop up a table. I was also in charge of the volunteers for line control and all that stuff. I would just grab a couple of volunteers, have them take off their orange t-shirt, sit at the after hours press table. I didn't really care if we sold books, but I just wanted them to hand out books and talk to people about after hours press. Me, Buddy, and Chris Eliopoulos basically started after hours press together. And now Buddy does comic book school. So I have after hours press all to myself. Chris is a very busy guy. So he's got his own stuff going on now. But yeah, that was a big perk, getting free tables in Artist Alley at all the Wizard shows. But it technically wasn't really free because I was working the whole time, you know, and I would always walk by and make sure everything's going okay, maybe sign a book or two and then keep walking, you know. But it was a creative outlet. It was a chance for me to write, a chance for me to give aspiring artists a chance to draw a book that's actually going to get published. So once in a while, I would bring in the artists. A couple of them lived in Columbus, Ohio, so I would pay for them to come to Chicago to sit at the Artist Alley table, and then we'd go out and have beers after. That was another perk, is the beers at the bars at night were with some of the biggest names in comics that people would wait hours and hours in line just to get an autograph from. We're sitting at the bar having two-hour conversations with, you know, at night over some beers. And to me, that was a huge perk, because getting to know these guys as people, it's a lot of fun, you know, and you're a little starstruck at times when you meet some of them. I mean, some of them have nothing to do with comics. You might meet Kevin Nash. You're hanging out with Kevin Nash or Mankind. I'm sitting in the green room with Mankind while he's devouring all the free cookies, all the gourmet cookies we have with him. And so we got to meet wrestlers and some of the celebs that would come and sign, like Aaron Gray or Lou Ferrigno or Peter Mayhew. I had to break up an argument between Peter Mayhew and the guy who had the booth next to him. Peter was pissed because he had scooted his stanchion over about a foot into Peter's space. And I was like, how are you gonna argue with Chewbacca?
Well, he's a big guy, understandably. He takes up a lot of
Like,
space.
move the curtain back, man. What the hell's wrong with you? And that was pretty much the end of it. And I brought him a couple of waters, for him and his wife, and he was happy. So, just little things like that. You get to meet people. Got to meet Tyler Mayne, the
Sabretooth and
Sabretooth from the original X-Men. The most random kind of celebrity introductions, and that kind of continued through my career. At Starlight Runner, then at Marvel. I'm hanging out at the Marvel booth, and the whole cast of the Avengers comes in, and they're having drinks like water and cookies and stuff, getting ready to go out on stage for their big thing. And then Stan Lee comes in like behind them, and it's like, yeah, it's just, I'm like the Forrest Gump of the comic book industry, where you just kind of, you're in a picture with Nixon or something, and
Meanwhile, back at Congers, you're talking about how, sometimes the magazine would maybe push some buttons of creators or publishers. In your
sure.
mind, is there one particular incident that maybe you had to be involved in, like smoothing out or anything like that?
The smoothing out was always the publisher, that was Garup, and or the editor, the actual writer. The writer of the articles, generally, there was a wall between them. And like, if you piss off Alex Ross or something, as the writer, you're not going to hear it, probably, unless shit rolls downhill. So you might hear it from Garup, but Garup will be the one that Alex would get upset with, And I did have to talk to Alex once. He was upset about something production related that I really didn't have anything to do with. He sent in one of his big paintings, because that's it was again, it was before a lot of digital stuff, he had to send in his paintings for us to scan, and then we would send it back. And he didn't think the resolution was very good on the scan, and he didn't like the color on it. I told him, if we reprint it, I'll make sure we fix that. But I hadn't really, I didn't scan it, and so, we're not going to give him color approval rights, to see the color proof before it goes to press. We could today. I could email him a PDF or something and have him just check it. But that's not how it was back then. So occasionally I would have to deal with something if like something's at a register, or sometimes signatures would be doubled. Whole signatures would be missing, but those are printer errors, so I had to yell at the printer and then get money back from the printer, or have them scrap it all and reprint the whole friggin' run. That's the kind of stuff that I had to deal with, and shipping problems. These books didn't get to this retailer on time, or that kind of stuff. But I always had the creative urge, and that's why I had to just start it myself with After Hours Press, because ever since Fred brought me up from intern to production manager, I was kind of pigeonholed as a business guy, and the creative side of me was kind of ignored. And in fact, people didn't see me as creative. So when I left, I got a job with Jeff Gomez at Starlight Runner. That's where I worked with Fabian for 3, 4 years. And then I went to Marvel, was an editor at Marvel, and made a lot of cool things. The M&M comics, custom things like this one for Norelco that we did, where it has all the different beards of Doctor Strange. It's just ridiculous. But we had to do a lot of stuff like that, and we had to create characters, so part of what I do now at After Hours Press is, for clients, I create characters, and if they want a custom comic that looks as good or better than a Marvel book, I know all the same people, so it's essentially, yeah, you want a painted cover by Scan, or by I don't know who. Just name a cover artist, I'll give them a call. And so, yeah, I mean, unless they have an exclusive deal, there's no reason they can't work and do a side job for me.
And with After Hours Press, so like, you know, when we talked to Mike Dolce, he's like, oh, you know, I could like slip in some advertisements or whatever, you know, like it went with the magazine. So did you ever advertise at Wizard or Wizard Edge or any of like for these independent publisher magazines?
Yeah, actually, I did. One of my jobs was placing PSAs, public service announcements. Now, magazines have to do that. If an article comes out and it's 7 pages and it ends up leaving a blank page in the magazine because you needed 8, they'll look for a PSA or something to just pop in to that spot. So you put in like an anti-smoking ad or something because you have like a whole file full of them. You know, these companies send you these PSAs that they hope that you'll run at some point. So you rotate them, anti-bullying, anti-smoking, whatever it is. And every once in a while, you'll have a half page or like a vertical or something like that that you have to fill. I'm also a graphic designer. So if I had a book coming out, I would just slap together an ad for After Hours Press, Celestial Alliance #1 coming out next week, or Foxwood Falcons #2, you know, those kinds of things. And so it really helped to have, you know, the ability to put an ad for my little indie book in Wizard, you know, so it helped people, hey, I've heard of that, and that was the value of it. So that was also a perk. And yeah, I was in more of a position to do that than Mike Dolce was, because I was the one popping those ads in and, you know, dealing with the printers and approving it and all that kind of stuff. So as long as it looked professional, they were cool with it, because it was doing them a favor, because they had a half page that they needed filled, or they had an extra page they needed filled. You know, and print is different than digital. You need to come into exact page numbers to fit the folios, you know, so you can't just give them an odd number of pages and have blank pages printed.
Yeah. So obviously, you know, you're getting your creative fix, you're working at Wizard, but what then led to your departure from Wizard 2009, 12 years with the company? Why was it time to move on? What was going on?
A little bit like Valiant, I was kind of chugging along. Everything was fine, doing my job, but the company wasn't doing so well. I mean, I put the print orders together, so I know the quantities that we were printing and how many we were shipping and printing and selling. And the numbers were, you know, when I got there, they were, for Wizard, they were like around 300K. They started to climb up. They got almost to a half million, you know, and then it was just a slow trickle down. A couple years having the number go down 2,000 to 5,000 regularly every month, you know, and maybe a spike here or there with some big event or something. We came up with a lot of programs to try to fix that, you know, like the half issues and the ace issues and all these different kind of business things. We tried different magazines. We did In Power. We did Toy Wishes. We did a Beanie Babies. Man, we were trying everything, but yeah, the company just wasn't doing as well. Even the numbers to the shows were not maintaining or growing, but they were kind of like just trickling down a little bit. And part of that was that people were copying the business model. So the competition was pretty fierce as far as magazines. And then there was online, like all these different comic news sites. Honestly, I never saw Wizard as a news magazine. I always saw it as more of an entertainment magazine. So for all the editors who were upset about getting beat to the punch by these news things who could put out daily stuff, in my opinion, nobody read Wizard for the timely news. You don't read a monthly magazine for timely news. You read it to be entertained. So I think they could have still leaned into that. But honestly, the online thing was a big disruption. I mean, you could see a lot smarter guys than us, like Rolling Stone and Sports Illustrated and all these other magazines. None of them survived either, or none of them survived in the same way that they were back then. They had to evolve or die. And Wizard was in that mode, evolve or die, and tons of people getting laid off. I actually made it to the end. I was one of like the last 10 or so to still be there. You know, and then after that, had some severance, and then I got that job at Starlight Runner and actually started leaning more into the creative stuff, which I really wanted to do anyway.
And so we got to ask, you know, we actually just had him on the podcast earlier this year, and this is a question that goes to everybody who is on the Wizard Files. And we have the big cheese himself. There's the myth. He promotes his own myth. There's, you know, everybody else's opinions. So we have to ask you, Darren Sanchez, Garib Sheamus, cool or fool?
I know it may not be a popular opinion, but I would say cool. I'm cool with him. He paid me well for 12 years. He helped put my kids through school and helped me move to the suburbs. I mean, I worked for it. I helped him straighten out his magazines. But, you know, I ran into him in San Diego a few years back, and we didn't walk on the opposite sides of the street or anything. I mean, when you run a business, you're gonna make some mistakes. And like a relationship, if things ended well, they wouldn't end. It always ends poorly. And sometimes you might do some things at the end in desperation that are out of character for you. You know, you try this or you try that, or you may be disingenuous or whatever it is, because you're desperate. You have to pay 20 people. And you're, you know, you got no money. Sometimes you do things that are not like you. But from what I've known of Garib before that, always a good guy. Played golf with him, did a lot of cool stuff with him, you know. And so I think my opinion might be a little bit different than others. People take it personally when you get fired. You have to, you know, it is personal. But if you fired a lot of people, it's not personal. It's something that you have to do when you run a business. And I think some people don't understand that.
Now, looking back 30 years beyond, you know, Wizard Magazine's original launch, what do you think is then the legacy of Wizard? Does it still have an impact on something that, you know, came through the pipeline now? Like where does Wizard rank in comic book history for you?
Well, I think it's overwhelmingly positive. I like thinking back to the Marvel bullpen. You know, you see it as something that doesn't exist anymore, but man, I wish it still did. It's the same with Wizard. It was kind of lightning in a bottle. So I don't know if you could do it again. There is no central place to go anymore for comic book news. There's 20 different podcasts you could follow to learn about either what's coming out in comic shops that week or the news about an event, or you want to follow some particular creator's podcast, you know, but there's no one central place that gives it to you with that sort of personality from an outsider's view. It's not Ethan Van Sciver talking about himself. It's Wizard talking about Ethan Van Sciver if they want to, or if they want to talk about what else was cool or the top 10, you know, those kinds of things. I think the industry could use that, because what it does is it gets everyone on the same page, and it kind of makes rock stars out of certain people, for better or for worse. You know, maybe you hate Stephen Platt's work. I don't know. But the Wizard loved it, and so did everybody else. But I believe Wizard had a big part in the success of Image, in the success of individuals like Rob Liefeld. I mean, these guys are talented anyway. I mean, you can't deny the talent of Jim Lee and Mark Silvestri or Todd McFarlane. But Wizard really helped them as far as people getting to know their names. Without that sort of vehicle right now, there's talented guys out there that don't have the same avenues to reach people that those guys were lucky enough to have. So, you know, I think the industry could use that. So I feel like their legacy is the success of Image, the success of a lot of creators who are still hot to this day. Sort of a nostalgia kind of thing. And if people are younger and maybe don't remember it or didn't get to experience Wizard World Chicago or some of the issues that came out before the magazine started to, you know, have to change a little bit because of whatever reasons, they missed out. It was a good time, and it was a fun time for me. I look back on it with nothing but good memories.
Yeah, you love to hear it. Yeah, that's good. So as we close out here, obviously you leave Wizard, you go on, eventually you're at Marvel. I'm curious, did your work at Wizard or connections you made lead to that? How did you get involved doing these awesome comics for various companies? Because I remember, like, there was like a Harley Davidson, like Avengers comic or something. I don't know if you were involved in that. I was just like, what is this?
That was me and Mark Basso. The connections started with Valiant, some through Wizard. Basically, knowing Fabian kind of got me in the door to talk to Dan Buckley. Because Dan and Fabian are friendly, and Dan got to see some of the work that I did for After Hours Press. I did a comic called Genie the Genius, where I created a children's character, kind of like Magic School Bus a little bit. The idea was that Genie was supposed to teach kids about cystic fibrosis, and I was paid to do that by Boomer Esiason and the Boomer Esiason Foundation, because they support CF. But I told Boomer I didn't think kids would want to read something from a character they had no idea who he was. So I convinced them to let me do three issues that were just fun stuff. Like Jeannie teaching you about dinosaurs, and then Jeannie's teaching you about space travel or about the microverse or just fun stuff and adventurous stuff. And then I kind of spun it off into the medical thing about what is cystic fibrosis. And I showed that stuff to Dan Buckley. I had interviewed about 9 times at Marvel. They didn't know where to put me. They didn't know whether to put me in the graphic design department, editorial, marketing, social media, ad sales, because I had done so many different jobs, even like production, you know, but I didn't want to do production and I didn't want to be the guy who, you know, worked on the website or any of that shit. I wanted to be involved with the comics and the creative stuff. So finally, when I talked to Dan and I showed him this stuff, they figured out, I think I know where to put you now. And so they put me in the custom team to work with clients and either create characters for them or create stories for them using Marvel characters. And so I've gotten to do Avengers, Black Panther, Deadpool, Guardians of the Galaxy. I've done like all the major Spider-Man, Miles Morales. I could bring in any villain I wanted as long as it passed through a Marvel brand to make sure that he wasn't going to be featured in a movie or something, you know. And even if he was, they would say, you can't use him till this movie is out for 6 months, so you can use him in November, you know, that kind of thing. So, okay, I can't use Thanos, but can I use Claw? And they're like, yeah, you can use Claw. Go ahead. You know, that kind of, so it was a lot of fun. And I came in kind of knowing already how to make comics, but I didn't know how to work Marvel's system. Like everything Marvel did was digital and it had to go through like half a dozen approvals between lawyers. And if it was a Spider-Man story, I had to send it to the Spider-Man editors just to make sure everything's cool as a courtesy. I mean, if I didn't, they had no recourse, but as a courtesy, I would show it to them. You know, I had to work with Ricky Purdon who's also a wizard guy.
Yeah. That's what I was just going to say. Yeah.
But I had to work with Ricky to make sure that the people I was planning to use, you know, were cool. And that, because sometimes, you know, Ricky has like a guy who's got an exclusive deal with Marvel and they're looking for something to put them on, you know? And so Ricky will be like, can you use this guy instead? I'm like, yeah, sure. Okay. And so we just check with everybody and make sure everyone knows what everyone else is doing. And so there's a lot of little systems, even to get paid, you got to like go online and do this and tracking your vacation, all these, it's just different, but I kind of got used to it. To me, it was a little unusual, very corporate. I came from the Army to Valiant, to Wizard, to Starlight Runner, which were all like very informal. Well, the Army was formal, but
now, obviously, like you said, you're your own boss. You're taking on these projects. So what is coming down the pipeline from After Hours Press? Where can people get in touch with what you're doing?
Well, I'm starting a new podcast called Comics After Hours. The first thing we're doing is I was hired by, this is going to be a weird out of left field sort of thing, but I was hired by the Morocco Ministry of Culture to bring a team of professional comic artists and writers to Morocco for an international book fair that they have in the capital city of Rabat. So in 3 weeks, we're all going out there. And part of what we're doing, we're going to run a big booth. It's going to be like comic book school meets the Marvel booth. You know, it's just going to be weird. We're going to do a lot of cool. So we might even do like a Top Chef sort of artist competition thing. So it's something Bernard Chang and I are working on, but we're going to have fun with it. And at the end of every show, it's a 10 day show. It's a long show. But at the end of every show around 4 or 5 o'clock, we're going to start our daily podcast. We do one to end every show. And the format is kind of, to talk about, you know, whatever's hot and a daily topic, you know, and then the last part of the show, we bring in a guest, a phone-in guest from, you know, all the guys have contacts in the industry. So like we haven't set the guest list yet, but we're talking to some pretty big names. So we're going to end it by bringing in a guest. Like we did it in November, the first run, we did it in Casablanca. We had guests like Bob Layton, Dan Chichester. We had a few. It was only a 4-day show, so we didn't have as many. But this time, we have a lot of planning to do, and we're going to have some even bigger names. And I'm also going to be talking to the team while we're there because we have 10 days in a hotel together. So we're going to be trying to figure out what our next creative venture is. We have some real talented guys. A couple of old Valiant guys, Sean Chen and Bernard Chang, are going to be there with me. and their wives, and a lot of younger guys, a lot of newer guys that I worked with while I was at Marvel. That's the next thing in After Hours Press. It's good money, and it's an opportunity to travel, and we're staying in a really nice hotel.
Sweet.
Yeah, it's going to be nice.
Where can people kind of keep track of that? Are you on social media? Do you have a website, YouTube channel?
I don't have a YouTube channel yet, but the ones that we did first were comicbookschool.com. And there is a YouTube channel for that.
Yeah.
That's Buddy Scalera's.
Yeah, we've had Buddy and Mike on. We've talked to them, yeah.
So if you go on to the Comic Book School YouTube page, you'll see interviews that me and Buddy were the hosts for all of those panels and all of those shows. This time, Buddy can't come, but I'm bringing Victor Dandridge, who actually started as a line control volunteer at one of our ChicagoCon shows. And now Vic is really well known as a moderator in conventions all around the country. People bring him in to moderate for some really big names. And it's funny that he's got his start working for me as a volunteer at Wizard World Chicago. So it's just kind of how it all kind of comes around. People ask me my advice for staying in the comic industry. And I tell them that your network of connections is your most valuable asset. Whenever you lose a job, whenever you're looking for leverage in some kind of situation, or you need somebody's email, whatever it is. So my best advice would be, don't be an asshole, because you need these people more than they need you. And do your thing, be creative. It's a very solitary thing being a creative person, but also try to be social once in a while and don't be an asshole. And that's my advice.
Words to live by. Well, Darren, thank you for being a nice guy, and thank you for being here and sharing all your stories. It really was a lot of fun to hear your behind the scenes. So we look forward to what's to come from After Hours Press, and we'll keep an eye out for the podcast.
Fantastic. Nice to meet you, and thanks for having me on.
Well, that does it for this edition of The Wizard Files. I want to thank Darren Sanchez again for those great candid stories of the world of comic books and Wizard Magazine. Definitely a lot of fun stuff I was not expecting to hear. But if you want to hear more of what we do at Wizards, the podcast guide to comics, check out our main episodes. That's right, where we go in depth on every issue of Wizard Magazine, specials, spinoffs. Plus, you can get more of The Wizard Files. That's right, we have over 40 interviews with past Wizard staffers as well as comic book professionals. These can all be found at wizardscomics.com. A total of 270 episodes in the archives that you can find for yourself. Of course, you can also check out what we're doing on YouTube at Wizards, the podcast guide to comics, where we have haul videos where we show our latest comic finds, vintage wizard items from back in the day, as well as we put our interviews up there and other fun videos. We have a series called Comic Card Crazy, where we open vintage packs of superhero and comic book trading cards from the 90s. You can check those out as well. If that isn't enough, go on over to patreon.com/wizardscomics to get your nostalgia fix. For just $5 a month, you are getting early release uncut versions of these episodes. There's always a little extra. Even this interview had a little bit at the end that we snipped off just for our patrons. But also, you get PDF scans of the issues that we cover. You're able to also get our 90s Super Cinema podcast, where we go in depth and have a fun discussion about movies from the 90s based on comic books and just superhero properties in general. That's a great monthly podcast that our patrons get to vote for. There are so many more perks beyond that. We're always dropping extra special content over at patreon.com/wizardscomics. But again, we want to thank you so much for checking out this episode. And until next time, we're closing the files.
This has been a presentation of Geekster Media.